Thank you all so much for being here. We are delighted, but it's bittersweet. We've had 4 weeks with Professor Lisa Parker from the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, where she directs the Center on Bioethics. And we're here now to put a bow on it. 4 weeks of talk about personalized medicine and the implications of genetic profiling in medicine and health, and the ways that it can be all the ways that it can become a bit of a sticky issue for medical and personal ethics. So, with that as a grateful introduction, I'll just say a word of prayer, and we'll get on the way. God, we thank you for this day, for this beautiful day, and for the opportunity to learn and consider the wisdom that you have put into this world and that is there for us to consider and act upon in our lives. We pray that we would serve your purpose. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, thank you very much. I will see, work on sharing. Oh, good, it's going to work. There we are. Share slideshow. Excellent. So I thank you so much for spending these mornings with me. I've enjoyed them tremendously. And today, I'm pleased to talk with you about genetic enhancement and maybe some myth busting, both about genetic enhancement, but also about what I call the myths of the meritocracy or myths of merit, which I think are particularly relevant when we think about the concerns that we have about genetic enhancement and why it concerns us. So the themes that we've talked about, just I won't rehash those from the past 3 weeks, but we'll say that today we're going to emphasize that genomics is primarily a tool, not a revolution, that genes mix with environments to produce the human body, well, to be, produce you know, all living bodies, our traits, our health, disease, abilities, disabilities. And similarly, genomics as a field must mix with other bodies of knowledge and actions to produce anything of value, whether that's treatment, prevention, the sense and actuality of being able to control something using genes and genetic tools. So as I mentioned last time, I don't embrace an idea of nature versus nurture. At most, it's nature and nurture, a combination, an interaction. But in fact, I'm going to suggest today that once we have knowledge, understanding of nature, including genetics, it all kind of becomes social. It all becomes a matter of what we do with it, that it becomes to some degree within our control, our power and our responsibility. So that what was natural or given becomes a matter of choice, even choosing to leave something alone, not touching it, not enhancing, not intervening, is a choice, a matter of responsibility. And so that the social realm of justice and responsibility comes to overtake the realm of the natural. And not really overtake in the sense that there ever were really two things, but that we come to realize that we can't think of them as divided. And so I'm enamored of this philosophy book by mentors of mine called From Chance to Choice. And it focuses on genetics and justice. And that's part of what I'll talk about today. As we move from thinking about genetic testing and the way that that can alter behaviors, you could intervene and have, as we talked last time, prophylactic mastectomy if you have genes increasing risk for breast cancer. And we move from thinking about altering our behaviors in light of information, actually altering genes, gene therapy, gene editing, genetic enhancement, I mean, for a long time, we've there was discussion in athletics, of course, about steroids and blood doping and then gene doping. The idea of techniques where genetically modified cells could be reinserted into the body or into an embryo, a zygote, or where genetic material is injected directly into tissue, or where viral vectors are used to deliver genetic material by incorporating into target cells after being injected into the target tissue or inhaled through an aerosol. This was the idea of gene doping that we have heard about in the news around athletics, but it's also the old time, if you will, way of thinking about genetic enhancement of any type. And although such direct manipulation of genes has long been kind of the holy grail of contemporary genetic medicine, only recently have techniques emerged that allow us to avoid some of the earlier safety concerns by directly editing the genome and being much more precise, avoiding perhaps many of the off-target side effects that could come with some of the other techniques. I'm not going to talk very much about these other techniques, or any of the techniques, in fact, because as I've said, I'm not really a scientist, and I don't want to get things wrong or take up our time with trying to elucidate the science, which some of you may know better than I. But gene editing, CRISPR, the use of clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats to remove some genes or insert other genes into the genome at particular, very precise points, has been the subject of controversy. For example, when a Chinese scientist claimed to use CRISPR to make the first genetically edited babies. Of course, that was in 2018 in November. Prior to that, in the United States, we had done something similar with human embryos, removing genes and replacing them with others to, in an attempt to eliminate a particular heart condition. But we did not bring those embryos to term, didn't bring them into a pregnancy. What Dr. He did was actually do this in embryos that were then grew into, became babies, became people. And this is generally not only frowned upon, but there are regulations against it throughout most of the world, either very, very restrictive, an attempt at a moratorium, prohibition, or at least highly regulated. But this is the kind of technology that we're now talking about. And the concern is that although it would be great to be able to use that technology as the US scientists suggested they could with regard, for example, to heart disease, that we're very nervous about doing it for enhancement purposes, to improve traits or improve abilities or tissues, whatever. And so nevertheless, I would suggest that this treatment enhancement distinction really begins to break down. And in fact, it's never really been all that clear. So it breaks down practically and conceptually in a lot of cases before we ever get to genetics. So if we think about something I actually wrote about as the first topic in my career, federal regulation of silicon breast implants back in the 1990s, there was concern about them rupturing and causing many problems. And so there was a lot of discussion about, well, why do we need silicon breast implants anyway? And a lot of women said, well, because after my cancer surgery, I want to be made whole, or after horrible burns, I want to be able to have breast reconstruction following my injury. But in reality, most of the silicon breast implants were being used for breast augmentation, for largely what people would call aesthetic purposes, or to enhance a woman's esteem, self-esteem, or regard from others, or necessary for a career to look different from the way she did so-called naturally. There's also then the opposite side, breast reduction Well, reduction for what reason? Well, for back pain, to improve posture, or just to improve self-esteem and social opportunities, where a woman who was born with very large breasts might have them reduced because she's tired of having the world think of her as, well, being known for her chest rather than for her brain, her ability, her talents, and so on. But it might also be a matter of you can't hold a violin and be as professional if you are too full-chested. So that surgery, which was it, a treatment or an enhancement? Ritalin for young people, is it treatment for their attention deficit disorder, or what happens when they simply begin to use it to focus their attention for studying? Or beta blockers used for hypertension, angina, regulation of heart rhythms, or to regulate the heart and other anxiety, physiological responses to anxiety brought on by performance, whether it's on the concert stage or on Zoom. So over time, in many cases, this clear notion that we think we have between treating a condition and enhancing something that isn't really wrong, doesn't need to be treated, it begins to break down. But in genetics, I think it also breaks down in another practical and scientific way, because to have a treatment genetically, you often have to enhance at another level. So to treat the heart condition, you needed to enhance at the cellular level. So that you can enhance a physiological function to make the whole organism, the person, normal, not enhanced, not better than well, but just well once again. You can enhance at the cellular level, the level of genes, in order to improve physiological function so that a person is restored to her previous state. So again, this notion of enhancement and treatment kind of breaks down. So the other thing I want to talk about today is myths of merit. And I want to do this because I think that we tend to believe as a society that genetic enhancement threatens merit by undermining the value of exerting effort on the level playing field. I'm going to talk about this in part in terms of sport, but I think in general, this is something that we think of. We believe that people who would use genetics to enhance themselves or to enhance their children are kind of getting away with something. And another way of looking at it is they're losing the opportunity to struggle with challenges, to overcome on their own, by their own bootstraps, any lack of ability that they might have. They miss something important. But I suspect that we in fact misvalue effort and merit in a certain way. And I think another myth of merit is believing that when we assume responsibility and exercise choice, that this will necessarily lead to a kind of hubris of so-called playing God, getting out of our lane, overstepping our proper bounds. And I want to ask the question of whether we could in fact act responsibly in the sense of assuming responsibility and in fact perhaps enhancing at some level in the body, maybe enhancing a whole person, but not act pridefully, not in a way that is immoral, unethical, unkind, and ultimately, I would say, unproductive. So John Rawls, who wrote A Theory of Justice in 1971, is probably the most influential philosopher I know in the area of justice theory. And he has an articulation of justice as fair equality of opportunity, claiming that we don't really want everyone to be absolutely equal, and we don't want exact equality of outcome. No matter what you do, that everybody arrives at exactly the same point. This is true in life, and I think it's true in sports. What we want is a level playing field in sports and in life. We don't want everybody to run exactly the same time in a race, or put in, always wind up the same income, the same activities, and so on. But as Rawls puts it, we want a situation where those with the same level of talent and ability and the same level of motivation to use them should have the same prospects of success in life, regardless of their initial social situation. So basically saying that a just society is one that ensures the conditions of fair equality of opportunity, that kind of metaphorical level playing field, so that the gifts, or what is bestowed upon us by the natural lottery, our genes, how our bodies interact with environments, that those that have traditionally been thought of as being given, then should interact with our social environments in a way that the social lottery doesn't determine the outcome, but instead our effort does. So that if the playing field is level, if there's equality of opportunity, then our natural abilities plus effort will lead to fair outcomes because, well, our income, whether we're born in the global south or the global north, whether we're born in a rural area or an urban setting, whether we're of continental ancestry from Africa, from Europe, from Asia, it shouldn't matter to the exercise of our effort in combination with our natural talents and abilities to result in a fair outcome. And then Rawls goes on to ask, so what does that mean for which kinds of inequalities we as a society need to redress? And he says, well, certainly, and I think most people agree, we should do away with formal and informal discrimination. We should get rid of, well, slavery, of Jim Crow laws, of informal discrimination, so that the only women who are hired as journalists are ones who will be deemed conventionally attractive on TV news, because that's not really relevant to their ability to be good journalists, to tell a good story, to research carefully. And then he goes on and talks about, well, the social lottery's effects, all those different contingent factors that result from unjust social structures, maybe we should redress those. So issues of where racism, where a prejudice against Appalachia or against rural communities or against inner urban areas, that those effects of the social lottery of luck of where you're born, how you're born, what your attributes are and how they are viewed socially, that we should do away with the effects of that. We should compensate for them in some way. But then it gets more controversial because some people would say that the effects resulting from both the social and the natural lottery should be redressed, mitigated, as long as those effects result from things that are beyond a person's control, called the brute luck view. So it's not just intentional discrimination or kind of unintentional discrimination and its effects, but wherever something that's beyond your control results in a different kind of outcome of well-being, that we should take steps to try to mitigate. But then what happens when the natural lottery itself is no longer beyond human control? It's no longer a matter of luck. Do we then have some sort of responsibility to try to mitigate the effects of the natural lottery? Or do we in fact entitle people to take control of that natural lottery. In this case, for today's discussion, taking control of, as far as we can, our genes. So the idea of gene doping, which is something that, again, comes up in sport, but it's a way of talking about genetic enhancement in a variety of different areas. So if, for example, the gene encoding for vascular endothelial growth factor could be developed, harnessed to increase vascularization for patients who have peripheral arterial disease. So from diabetes, from heart disease. That same gene transfer technique could be used to enhance vascularization in athletes who could then benefit from an increased oxygen supply to their muscle tissues. So again, we see a breaking down of that treatment and enhancement. It's going to be very hard to regulate one or the other. And then the question is, and actually, why should we, if some people are just born with better, you know, oxygenation in their tissues, better than others? Why shouldn't those others be able to bring their levels of oxygenation up to somebody else's, kind of level their own personal, natural, not playing field, but abilities? So assuming the genetic modification is someday relatively safe, we don't have concerns about well-being then to stop us from genetic enhancement. We need to decide whether genetic enhancement is permissible based in part on whether it's fair. And if we look at that in the context of sports, what we think is that in sports, what we value is superior developed ability, not just the pure natural ability. We don't just look at somebody with big muscles and say, wow. We look at how well she lifts weights, how well she runs, whether she is able through her training and so on to develop her ability and then win the race, lift the weights, throw farther than someone else. So it's partly innate ability, which we admit is unearned, not meritorious in particular. It's just luck. But it's combining that with individual effort, and it's the effort we think is earned, and that is a source of merit. You combine those two, you get developed ability that leads to a win, to a success. That's not just lucky, but a result of effort, a result of something that we merit, and we merit praise for, that we value. So that's an interesting view, particularly if we think of it as not just applying in sports, but applying elsewhere. But in sports, we have recognized that those unearned genetic endowments of athletic abilities, we don't give awards for those. We could otherwise just do gene testing and give a prize without anybody actually having to run the race. No, what we prize is that merit. But then we have a problem when we recognize that we're now discovering that there are genes related not only to how rapidly your heart rate recovers after a race, how easy it is for you to build muscle and how big your muscles are going to be, how quickly and effectively you burn nutrients and burn fat for energy, how quickly you recover from an injury, a soft tissue injury. Not only genes for that, but we're beginning to discover that there may be genes associated with motivation for exercise. So for some people, it's going to be easier to exert effort. And that may be in part genetic. So now what happens to this idea that effort is meritorious if some people also have a leg up on that as well? But we've also known for a long time that with regard to effort, it's not just genes, that's a new finding. But we've probably, if we think about it, have known for some time that other things affect how easy it is, how effective it is to exert effort. We know, if we think about it, that social class affects your belief system. Those who are born into lower socioeconomic levels, at least in the capitalist communities, societies, tend to attribute their success to a matter of luck, to fate, to good fortune. Sure, I worked hard, but it really took a lot of luck for me to get where I am. Whereas in fact, those who are in higher socioeconomic levels tend to believe that it's all due to their self-efficacy, to their effort. We know that past experience also affects your beliefs in whether it's going to work out, how effective your effort's going to be. We know that racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, experiences of violence and trauma and stigma, these all feed in, these past experiences all feed into our beliefs in whether in luck or in human agency, self-efficacy. And all of those beliefs affect how easy it is to work hard, to exert effort. We know that many factors affect of stress of racism, lower socioeconomic levels, particularly poverty, lead to decision fatigue, ego depletion, taking the feeling of taking the easier way out and not quite having it in oneself. In general, now not everyone, of course, there are of course exceptions, but as groups, these seem to be social factors that affect effort. And all of these social factors are in fact beyond one's individual control, just as one's genes are beyond one's control. So what should we be thinking about effort? And of course, it's not just athletic ability, but there are other cases where effort is important. And we are discovering in the context of genetics and education, people are developing polygenic risk scores or polygenic scores for educational attainment, being able to predict based on what we talked about last time, a bunch of individual genes, each having a small effect on mathematical ability or language acquisition ability, facility with imagery, memory. And there's concern that discovery of these genetic factors, each of which making a small contribution into educational attainment, can lead to stigmatization, self-stigmatization, teachers treating people differently based on those scores if those scores become known, and people treating themselves differently if they come to know what those scores are. That there will be changes in their self-perception of their competence and their academic efficacy, and that some may work harder, say, I'm going to overcome these strikes against me, these obstacles that even my own genes present to me. Others, however, may become fatalistic and may find that their prediction of more difficulty in school, more difficulty learning, will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So even here, we see a combination of genetics and behaviors, responses to the genetics, attitudes, and so on, and the effect that it has not only on the ability, like building muscles or having memory, but on the effort that one exists to build those muscles or to memorize. So what would my recommendations be? Well, this is where it gets a little bit more thorny for me, in case everything up to this point was perfectly clear. My recommendation is that we not avoid genetic technologies maybe polygenic risk scores. Those I think are way too early that we're relying on them. But in general, in the long arc of time, that we not avoid genetic technologies, even don't avoid gene editing, but embrace them judiciously at some levels, cellular level, physiological level, and maybe level the whole person, that we not just avoid assuming responsibility or avoid taking the shift from chance to choice, that we not hide behind fears of being of hubris or of playing God, because we already sort of play God or try to control a lot of things in so many social and behavioral ways. We do this as parents when we encourage or really encourage, like force piano lessons, batting practice, good study habits. We're working hard to shape our children. We do it as policymakers, where we try to set up the conditions in which people will, in fact, thrive and have rewarding lives. Why is that not sort of playing God, if you will, or at least assuming responsibility for things that if we just left them alone, well, we would still be responsible because we haven't done anything, but we keep our hands out of it. What I would suggest that instead of avoiding embrace of genetic technologies, that we would give up some of our myths of merit, that we give up on this idea that effort is largely or mostly individual, and that merit itself is always meritorious, as in kind of morally justified and good. That the give up our belief in what I think is a myth, that the result of our effort is 100% earned and not at all a matter of luck or fortune. Give up on the idea that the moral universe kind of aligns prosperity and success with merit, desert, and aligns failure with wrongdoing or with slacking off. And because in fact, some people work very hard and they still fail. We've seen this a lot since, in this century, right? And so here's where I take this attempt at a theological turn. And it's based on a book from Michael Sandel, who's a philosopher, political philosopher at Harvard. It's called The Tyranny of Merit, and he asks, what's become of the common good? And in his second chapter, he draws some parallels, looks back in American history, US history, and tries to draw some parallels in the Protestant, Puritan, work ethic realm. From Luther and Calvin and through to a prosperity gospel, if you will, and secular beliefs, where Protestant, the success is salvation. And in the secular realm, it's success, winning the race, money, power, just economic security even. And he asks these questions. In the secular realm, is the success earned and thus deserved, or is it beyond one's control? Is it the result of good fortune? Of course, that's a false dichotomy. It's probably, a combination, right? He draws out the point that what he calls the Protestant work ethic began as a tense dialectic, a tension between grace and merit, between helplessness and self-help. And he argues, that in the end, merit drove out grace, that an ethic of mastery and self-making overwhelmed the ethic of gratitude and humility, grace. And he goes on to talk about, and here he quotes sociologist Max Weber, that the idea has emerged that the fortunate person is seldom satisfied with the fact of being fortunate, but also needs to know that he has a right to his good fortune, that he deserves it, and above all, that he deserves it in comparison to other people. He wishes to be allowed the belief that the less fortunate also merely experience their due, and thus there isn't much of a responsibility to do something for the less fortunate. We kind of see this, I guess, in our view that people who are unfortunate and maybe need medical assistance, need food assistance, need welfare, need to be showing that they're trying to get a job and need to be working. So Sandel goes on and he talks about the notion that we are free human agents capable of rising and succeeding by our own effort is only one aspect of meritocracy. He said, equally important is the conviction that those who succeed deserve their success. And he calls this triumphalist. This triumphalist aspect of meritocracy generates hubris, overweening pride among the winners, and humiliation among the losers. This triumphalist aspect of meritocracy, he says, is a kind of providentialism without God, at least without a God who intervenes in human affairs. The successful make it on their own, but their success attests to their virtue. And he's calling this into question. So he contrasts an ethic of fortune that appreciates the dimensions of life that exceed human understanding and control. An ethic that sees the cosmos does not necessarily match merit with reward. It leaves room, he says, for mystery, tragedy, and humility. He contrasts that with what he thinks we as a society are embracing, an ethic of mastery, which places human choice at the center of everything, including the spiritual order. And here he's quoting a cultural historian, Jackson Lears. Lears says, a culture that is less intent on the individual's responsibility to master destiny might be more capacious, more generous, more gracious. Recognition of the unpredictable character of fortune and fate might lead people to imagine their own misfortune and transcend the arrogance of the meritocratic myth to acknowledge how fitfully and unpredictably people get what they deserve. So thinking about genetics, I think these authors, thinkers are saying that if we recognize and kind of embrace and just rest with the genes that we're given, well, we would recognize misfortune, fortune, it's not all of our doing. We should give up on the idea of trying to control at least what's in our genes. And this is something that Sandel very much says. He writes against genetic enhancement. He makes the case against perfection, as he calls it. So, which I take a little bit of issue with. He concludes that the providentialist notion that people get what they deserve comes in two versions. One is hubristic and the other is punitive, and he rejects both. And I agree with that. The punitive side is that people get what they deserve. So if you have something bad happen to you, you must have deserved it. And in the secular sense, it's probably that, not that you sinned, but that you didn't try hard enough. And the other arm is the hubristic, the prideful side that, well, you're tilting at windmills, you're trying to play God, you're trying to be perfect, and that will only cause trouble, either cause harm or in itself is a harm because it undermines our ability to be gracious, caring, compassionate, empathetic. He very much rejects the use of genetics to enhance people because he says that it is hubristic. He thinks we should more or less rest with our natural God-given talents in our genes. Now, he's not opposed to using genetic information to treat genetic diseases, to prevent their onset. He probably is not even against using gene editing, that CRISPR technology, if we could remove a genes or alter the genes, I should say, that cause, say, cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs or maybe heart disease. If we could alter those genes, that he probably thinks is okay. But we shouldn't do it in a way that makes us better than restoring us to so-called normal. But it's hard to know what normal is. If I think back to my first research project around breast implantation as treatment for cancer, well, it doesn't treat cancer. It treats having been treated for cancer by having a mastectomy. It restores one to a former appearance, to a normal appearance, but it's not related to a woman's health. And in fact, those silicone breast implants caused a lot of ill health when they ruptured or when they hardened or there was an immune response to them. Not always, but it did indeed happen, and fairly frequently. So there is a question about what it means to restore either to a personal normal or to some sort of human normal, and where we draw those lines between restoring to normal health and enhancing. But what he most strongly rejects is the seeking of perfection by any means, whether it's, and I'll use a stereotype here because it's an easy shorthand, as stereotypes usually are, of being a tiger mom and pushing a child so hard to be a concert pianist, a baseball player who's really good, a great literary artist, whatever, that degree of pushing. He would reject that because that's pushing someone too far toward perfection and has all sorts of negative outcomes. But he also rejects seeking that perfection by means of genetic enhancement. I would wonder, in fact, whether in some cases a parent might do less damage if they could safely enhance a child genetically as opposed to behaviorally expending all of their effort and their pushing to have the child expend all of that effort and pushing. Maybe true for oneself, about oneself, to have enhancement as opposed to expenditure of a whole lot of effort. So what I'm asking about is whether we can truly maintain that there's an ethical distinction between employing genetic or social enhancement, and asking whether once genetic enhancement is possible, and I would add sufficiently safe as other medical interventions are, can we avoid the responsibility of using it or of not using it? We'll be responsible either way, as long as it's possible and sufficiently safe and effective. So I would suggest that we shift the focus from genetic enhancement to enhancing our discourse, our moral discourse, and our behaviors. That what we need to do is avoid the hubris, the heartache, and the harms of seeking perfection as some probably unattainable ideal, but embrace the benefits of both exerting effort and using genomic tools to enhance capabilities and outcomes. Why should we not? And that we should be more gracious, more generous, more empathetic, more cooperative, and reduce this comparison, competition, and an adherence to caste and hierarchy where to be successful, we always have to be more successful than someone else, as opposed to achieving our own goals, our own degree of accomplishments and pleasures and personal best times in a race. So that, I believe, was my last slide, perhaps even my last thought, but I would be very happy to hear yours. Thank you.
Am I able to ask a question? Can you hear me?
You are. Yes, I can hear you.
I'm Bobby Hartman. So it occurs to me, I mean, we've been doing a lot of thinking about inequality lately, particularly racial inequality and economic inequality. And it, so I'm, my mind is already in that vein. But what I'm thinking here is the kinds of things that are being floated. I'm not saying you're suggesting them, but you're acknowledging they're out there. Are going to have to do with access. And if there's a way to enhance one's mental, physical, whatever ability we're talking about, isn't that going to be just another step in further dividing the haves from the have-nots?
Within the current system, I think it absolutely would, because presumably the access to that, call it treatment or that intervention, that enhancement, if it's made on the basis of the, if the access is on the ability to pay basis, it certainly would make an even wider gap between the top one or three or whatever percent and the rest of us, and indeed those who are really less well off. But if on the other hand, there were a way to use enhancement to improve the, make it easier for those who currently have less to accomplish more in the same amount of time, that could be an enhancement to, say, memory, to ability to do with, to be very crass and concrete. If poor people could accomplish the same amount as rich people on less sleep, they might catch up more quickly. Now, all of that is leaving a whole lot of things in place. So the idea that we, my real concern about doing that is that instead of actually taking care of social structures that maintain rich people as rich and poorer people as poor, rather than redressing those inequalities, we just say, well, okay, let them have those genetic enhancements that allow them to get by with a little bit less sleep and they can just work a lot harder. It, in fact, you're right, I think you would agree, would reinforce the inequalities that are already here. But the problem, I guess my point is not the genetic enhancements. It's the either making access to them available on the basis of ability to pay, just the way we make the enhancement of Ivy League colleges to large extent or other social legs up available on the basis of the ability to pay, or to, it keeps the same social structures in place. The problem is the social structures and the inequalities, as you're pointing out, not of genetic enhancement itself or genetic technologies that we have a reason to fear. Sorry if that was a little convoluted.
Thank you. It's clarifying.
Thanks.
So many things to think about in what you said. But a couple of things stand out. One is the assumption that is very basic to us, that, you know, even in, you know, in the gospel, Jesus talks about the, our inclination to equate health with merit. There's the parable of the blind man where Jesus encounters a blind person and says, and his disciples say, you know, who sinned, this blind man or his parents, so that he was born blind? And Jesus' response is, heck with that. Let's just heal him.
Right, right. And what a philosopher might say, I mean, because we've invented all of this jargon, is that that's a category mistake. That to talk about health, blindness, disability in terms of sin is just as wrong as talking about, you know, trees in terms of I don't know, mineral, whatever, it's a hard. It's just, it's the wrong category. There's sin, there's right and wrong doing. And then there's this stuff over here that's misfortune. But the problem does become when we can use our right doing or wrong doing to affect whether someone is born with a disability, with a severely painful condition and so on. Then we begin to ask, now have the categories become blurred? Because now we bring that ability, that outcome into the realm of the parent's control or society's control. Not because blindness is a reflection of mom and dad having done something bad, you know, cheated a business partner or you're lied, and thus their child is born blind as punishment. No, not that. But the responsibility might be that if they had an easier way to make the child see, and they didn't avail themselves of that, is that wrongdoing? Is that a mistake?
So you mentioned in your last slide, I think it was the very last slide, the problems of leaning too heavily on hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And I just want to ask you to what extent can we overcome a very fundamental, not even human, but biological impulse to seek a social hierarchy? And for illustration, I have this vivid memory of my son who's studying animal behavior, looking out the window on a bitterly cold January day at the birds lined up on the roof next to a chimney. And he pointed out to me, you see the bird close to the chimney in the heat? He's the bird with high social status. Mm-hmm. And the lowest social status is the farthest from the heat. And they just naturally find that social order. So I'm just wondering how can we overcome that very fundamental impulse to establish a social hierarchy, whether it's because of based on disability or wealth or ableism or athletic performance.
Right. So it's interesting. So a quick answer, which I don't really embrace, is some people think we could actually use genetic enhancement to change our attitudes, our behaviors, or change that, what you're calling sort of an innate desire to establish hierarchy, that we could somehow find the many genes that might be related to that. They haven't been discovered yet, maybe never will be, but that we could change them. So we could breed it out, or we could gene edit out this desire for hierarchy. But I would also suggest that unlike birds, we do have reason, social structure. We can argue with each other about the value of maintaining the social structure rather than a more cooperative social structure. We can have those arguments. We're a little different from birds. We could also ask whether the being closer to the chimney is a product of being the higher social status, or if that's what higher social status is. He's the one who makes it closer to the chimney in the heat. Therefore, he's at the top of the heap, or I guess with birds, we'd say the head of the pecking order. But that's just what it is. It's not also all these other things. It's not the social status in the sense that we might mean social status. Now it might turn out that he also has the brighter feathers, pick of the mates, that he is somehow deferred to, that people do bring him the worms. Birds, his fellow birds do bring him the worms. It may be multifaceted, this social structure, this being closer to that which is valued and good, whether it's heat or worms or mates. It may all congregate together. But we're the ones who could question that and say, would we actually be better off somehow if we created a social structure that was not as hierarchical? If we resisted this impulse not only to be better, but to be better than someone else, and to get our extra kick of pride at being better off than someone else. We at least have a shot at it. We are having this conversation, which suggests that there are tools for making those arguments. as well as putting some restrictions on how far one can go with, you know, if we have this natural impulse and we don't do anything about it to eliminate it, so we always want to maintain a hierarchy, we do at least, we've made some strides. We don't say that those who are at the higher social level in the hierarchy, they can't enslave those who are underneath them. They can't abuse them in that way. They can no longer sexually harass them and get away with it. Well, they probably, you know, they do when they can, but we at least have rules against that now. So I think those are other things that we're doing.
Yeah. I see Bob Fraser ready to ask.
Yeah, I think this ties very nicely back to John Wilson's seminar last month. I believe it was Niebuhr that said that the individual, through effort and training, could occasionally put others' interest before his own, but that it was very hard for an organization to do that. And that this is what we're struggling with. Does genetics offer another means or a supplement to doing this? And I think it also ties into the thought that the great religions, when they're at their best, are mostly about compassion.
That's a wonderful observation. And I will say that, I mean, a little of my biography is that I wound up in a department of human genetics and thinking about genetics kind of as a fluke. It wasn't my burning passion or the thing I was most interested in terms of science and medical care. And so I've always used genetics and analysis of technologies and advances there as a way of trying to talk about the things that I think are really most important and most interesting. So in some sense, my kind of promoting or embracing of and genetics and even suggestion that, well, genetic enhancement may not be all that bad because I don't really think it's the real problem, is more a way of pointing out that I do think the need for compassion and the avoidance of foisting our views on others or being so prideful that we think we have the only right way or and that competition is, you know, always good and justifies the maintenance of hierarchy and avoidance of cooperation. Those are really the points that I think are more important. What we do about the genetics is somewhat, I think, well, it should be an outcome of those other conversations. And that in fact, we have so many things that we could intervene on right now, rather than intervening in the genome, that it makes a whole lot more sense to kind of edit our lives than to edit our genes or to edit our social institutions.
Yeah. Bob, I see you ready to say something, Bob Dilley.
Yeah, I'm really struggling with this. Let me kind of jump in the middle of it. I mean, it's maybe my engineering background. I kind of look at the extremes of a decision and then the middle, try to figure out where the middle is. What I'm grappling with is, do we as a species, frankly, have the maturity to make prudent decisions as to where to draw the line? We talk about, it's all full of scripture, all filled in scripture, this idea of how much is enough, basically. And our culture is not very good at saying, I have enough. Now it's time to share. We tend to go in the opposite direction. When the more we have, the more we feel we need to acquire.
I'm sorry.
The question is, do we have the maturity? Do we have the maturity to handle the decisions we're confronted with?
Yeah. Well, I think unfortunately, the short answer is, you know, no. We didn't with regard to a whole lot of weaponry we've developed, a whole lot of things, technologies and ideas and sort of social practices that we've developed, we didn't have the maturity to manage those well. But somebody's going to manage, somebody's going to develop them. So I think rather than only say, trying to put the brakes on the development and focusing solely on that, instead really redoubling our efforts to work on the maturity and not being bedazzled by the technologies, but and focused on them, but instead to really focus on the maturity and to say, well, then, you know, what do we need to be able to use atomic power or genetic technology, you know, for good and responsibly? But I agree that we see over and over, whether it's with extraction of resources from our environment, whether it's genetic technology, whatever, it's a struggle. It's probably always going to be, though, a struggle. We're never going to probably perfect it and get it 100% right. I hope we get better at it. And part of that getting better at it, I think, does have to do with going back to separating success and accomplishment and attainment of ever more goods and kind of good from kind of moral goodness and moral merit. And if we separate those, and not necessarily, I won't say that one has to then embrace a sort of, it's all God-given, almost predestined grace that we have nothing to do with, but to recognize that they are separable. You can tease apart a person's moral value and their success, their kind of moral merit and what they accomplish their ability and their disability, and so you separate those. I think that's an important beginning for development of that appropriate maturity to govern the abilities that we keep developing.
So I'm going to leave it there for the recording and say thank you very much. I still have more questions, and I'm sure I do too, but this has been wonderful. This has been an excellent series. And a whole lot to think about packed into this last day. Thank you so, so much.
You're most welcome. And I apologize for packing so much in, but thank you for sticking with it and for all of your comments. And for those who after today have other things that they'd like to discuss, you can find me at University of Pittsburgh at lisap@pitt.edu. And I'd be happy to talk with any of you further.
Thank you.